Our speaker today is Ananda, and he is going to talk about the world falling apart. So please welcome Ananda.
Hey, thanks so much for this opportunity. The title of the talk is the title of my forthcoming book, which I hope will be published by the end of the year, so stay tuned for that. I think what set me off on this course, take you way back to 2012, the Mayan calendar. And you recall everyone was talking about it, December 21st, 2012, and it was going to be the end of something. People were talking about it. I remember the harmonic convergence back in 1987, right? 25 years to go. Now, of course, on December 22nd, Walmart's was still open. The lights were on. What? People kind of stopped talking about it and thinking about it. But I read this really interesting book called The 2012 and the Transformation of Consciousness by this guy named Carl Kalaman. And he was the first person that I'd encountered that talked about when the Mayan calendar began, right? Because if you don't know the beginning date of the Mayan, what's the big deal about the end date? History is super important. And what he pointed out is that the beginning of the Mayan calendar was 5100 BCE, 5,000 years before Christ. And of course, I don't know what was going on in the Yucatan, where the Mayans were active at that time. But that date, thereabouts, is probably the most important date in history, because it's the beginning of history. It's when the first writing occurred, the first cities, the first pyramids, really the template for the way we live today. Just in maybe four very small cities in Egypt and Sumer, each with a population of maybe 4,000 or 5,000, tiny little towns. But they began something that now surrounds the planet in a stranglehold, a death grip. And it was occurring to me that December 12, 2012, it's not the end of the world, it's the expiration date of patriarchy. And we've all bought half and half or hamburger or cider, and there's an expiration date stamped on it. And we all know it doesn't just go bad on that date. You can kind of game it out for a few days, maybe even a week. Right? I've milked my half and half, so to speak, for 2 weeks past that date until the lumps just got too horrible. What if we look at December 12, 2012 as the sell-by date for civilization? And if you look at the world since 2012, they started getting bizarre a little before that, but they've gotten downright surreal in the last dozen years. And they continue to get more surreal. I don't need to go into the detail. It's in the newspaper every day. And what's interesting is the Mayans weren't the only people talking about something like this. The Buddha, not a prophecy-oriented guy. His whole program is about being in the now. But he did apparently make one prophecy, that 2,500 years after him would come a time of chaos and darkness when the Dharma would be forgotten, and a new Buddha, Maitreya, would rise up. And his teachings or her teachings would surround the planet. Well, if you do the math, 2,500 years after Buddha is right about now. And as Thich Nhat Hanh points out, Maitreya might not be a person. We don't need a Buddha 2.0 or a Jesus 2.0. We've seen what happens when men stand on pedestals like this and tell you stuff. It's not helpful. Thich Nhat Hanh says, what if Maitreya is a community of people following the Dharma together? And so that's a key part of it. And of course, it wasn't just the Buddha. You can look in all the Abrahamic tradition. For Orthodox Jews, they're all preparing for the end of days. The Messiah is coming. All the conditions on the planet are matching right up with the prophecies. Of course, Christians, evangelical Christians, see a second coming appearing, and some of them have a very strange selection of who that might be. And even in the Muslim traditions, in the hadith sayings attributed to Muhammad, it was believed that a time of chaos would occur, and then the 12th imam would reappear with black flags leading the righteous to a battle for the future of the planet that would take place around Damascus in Syria. So I may not agree with ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but their black flags represent their belief that something is coming. And finally, in astrology, the age of Aquarius. I mean, you can't get two astrologers to agree when that would be, but they all agree it's right about now. So what interests me here is you have six different systems which don't agree on anything. Several of them have never heard of each other, all independently prophesying a time very much like we're seeing, and an event, some kind of time of great chaos and great transformation occurring. Scientific proof is two or more, and this is six. So that got me very interested. So I started thinking about it, and I realized part of the good news is that we've been here before. This is not the first major turning. To look, find that, you got to go back about 200 or 300,000 years ago to where the first Homo sapiens appeared on the planet. And again, like all great apes, at night, they went up into trees to sleep. Unfortunately, large cats like lions and leopards can climb trees too. And early paleoanthropologists discovered that a preponderance of early hominid skulls, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, all the way back, had this very distinctive pattern of four puncture wounds in their skulls. This is how our ancestors were harvested from trees at night. And again, it wasn't the leading cause of death. Dental decay killed a lot more people than big cats. But the terror of every night when you went to bed, and we're talking about for thousands, millions of years, you didn't know who in your family was going to be there with you. Because when the big cats came up the trees, there was nothing we could do. However, fire, amazing thing. Now, our Homo erectus ancestors probably started fooling around with fire about a million years ago. But the problem with fire, has anybody here ever had it get out of control on them? Terrifying. Anybody needed to start a fire that wouldn't get going? You know, remember Jack London's To Start a Fire? It takes you through the agony of how hard a fire is to get going. Fire is very complex and very whimsical. If you don't have an abstract way of communicating about possible scenarios, future scenarios, past scenarios, and a variety of protocols, fire is going to be very hazardous to work with. Because remember, we're talking about Africa, hot and dry. So I guarantee you that our earlier Homo erectus ancestors screwing around with fire, it was great for a while. You could keep the big cats off for a while. You'd make meat taste. But eventually it would get out of hand and burn up the whole pack. And people would say, never doing making that mistake again. You needed to have language in order to work safely with fire over time. And interestingly enough, the archaeological evidence for repeated controlled use of fire dates back to about 200 or 300,000 years ago, which is when Homo sapiens first appeared. So fire and language was the first turning. And all of a sudden, we could level the playing field with big cats. We could combat our greatest terror that seemed completely uncontrollable. Because you have a watcher at the bottom with some embers, and they see the big cat's eyes, you light some brands, you get people out of the tree, and the big cats think twice. So that was huge. And it's interesting to think about the Huichol tribe in central Mexico who used the peyote cactus. Their word for fire is tatawari, which means the oldest grandfather or the first shaman. And it's interesting, even though they're not still in the first turning, they practice agriculture, their culture goes back. And if you think about what fire and language do, it's just like a shaman. You take these inert sticks, and suddenly you have this third entity that you can make as big as you want to put off your most scary predators. You can also stay warm at night, and it would extend our days. Great apes typically go to bed at nightfall. With fire, you could stay up much later. You had extra hours in the day to practice this new skill, conversation, the other thing that makes us human. Interestingly enough, if you look at the word Homo sapiens, it means wise person or shrewd person or a person who knows. If you look at the word shaman, which comes from a Siberian tribe, the Tungus tribe, saman, it means one who knows. Homo sapiens is another word for shaman. And to me, that is some of the best news I've heard all day. Because shamans, I mean, if you remember those wonderful interviews with Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers, when Bill Moyers asks Joseph Campbell, so who are the shamans today? And Joe doesn't even pause. He goes, oh, artists. And what do artists do? They make stuff up. They use their imagination, the nation of images. They become inspired from the Latin word filled with spirit. And by drawing on those other forms of consciousness, they find solutions to insoluble problems. And they did a pretty good job. Because when we started out, we were a bunch of apes in Africa. And with fire and language, we populated 6 out of 7 continents, which is a pretty good percentage, right? I challenge you to find a sports team that's doing that well. enabled our DNA to travel across 200,000 years. They may have believed in some things that weren't true, and certainly things we can't see with scientific instruments, but the proof is in each one of you. Where'd you get your DNA? Where did that go back? And the real question is, will our best thinking carry us another 200,000 years? So just hold that question for thought. So the problem, though, rose as humans migrated up out of Africa. There's a big blockade at the top of the continent. We call it the Mediterranean now. It's a bottleneck. And as the population increased and people started crashing into each other, hunting and gathering stopped being a successful way to survive. Because to hunt and gather, you need a very small population and a very large territory. So starvation, disease, war, and again, the breakthrough was the seed. Think of what a seed is. For 200,000 years, grass seeds were something we ate. But some bright bulb realized when you put them in the ground, they grow and you get 30 or 40 or 50 more of them. And what's interesting, if you ever remember the movie Groundhog Day, you know, you leave a guy in the same day for enough times and eventually turns into a decent person. You leave humans with the knowledge of seed germination, and within about 6,000 or 7,000 years, an amazing thing happens. Instead of being hunter-gatherers, all of a sudden they're living in cities. Instead of being egalitarian, they're forming hierarchies. Instead of communicating orally, they're inventing writing. It's a repeatable experiment, because the same thing happened a little later in the Great Plains of China, where hunter-gatherers started bunching together, except the grass that they were eating became rice. And then a little later, in the Yucatan, same thing happened a third time, except the grass there was corn. And each time, humans left with seed germination, after about 5,000 or 6,000 years, are suddenly living in cities, developing social hierarchies, placing wealth and status as their top priorities, and using writing to keep the whole thing going. So there was an incredible breakthrough. It meant that we could live in much larger numbers, and then people could specialize, and we could develop poetry, and we could develop astronomy and mathematics and the law. Fantastic breakthrough. But things come to an end, because this system, driven by wealth and status, male-dominated, coordinated by duality, is now on the brink of killing the planet. And it's terrifying. If you really focus on the crises, and what's even scarier is all the best minds with billions of dollars are not solving the problem. It's a little bit like Eckhart Tolle talks about. You have a string of fires around a town, and the chief of police says he's going to solve it, and the problem is the chief of police is the arsonist. Our whole way of life, all the people we're looking to make decisions are motivated by wealth and status, right? That's why they got to the top of their institutions. That's why they got the big grant. Those motivations make it impossible to see another way of doing things. It's like Einstein said, the level of thinking that created the problem can't solve it. So the question is, what is the next consciousness? And the key thing to keep in mind, to my mind, is if you look at the chakra system, it's a blueprint for a complete human being. And as a collective, we've only got up to about the third chakra. Survival, sexuality, personal power. Those are our primary motivators. That's what most books and movies are about. That's what most ads focus. That's what most political elections are about. We're only 3 out of 7. That's starting to look like the Red Sox. Not so good. So the next step is the heart. And the heart is the scary one, because you have to drop your defenses. You have to open your heart to other people. You have to stop seeing other people as opposition and seeing them as yourselves. And to me, what really excites me about the third turning is it's happening right here. You know, and I know people talk about, oh, there used to be so many people at the celebration, blah, 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 blah. That's a huge preoccupation of the second turning, numbers. It's all about numbers and maximizing output and maximizing. We see where that gets us. The fact is, we have to go back to the first turning. How many of our ancestors were fooling around with fire and language? Maybe a dozen, all alone in the middle of Africa, a gigantic planet. They had no idea that what they were fooling around was going to permit billions of humans to have full lives all over the planet. And think about those first cities. We're talking about patriarchy. We're talking about world domination. We're talking about 4 villages of 4,000 or 5,000 people. That was it. A good round of bubonic plague or the mumps could have wiped them right out. They were incredibly fragile. We forget that it took them 5,000 years to become this dominating. I mean, I remember walking into the World Trade Center and these huge towers, early 90s, dominating. It's like fascist architecture. I'm so insignificant. And a few years later, they were gone in an hour and a half. The third turning, by necessity, will have to start very, very small. Opening your heart to people is dangerous. All the image we carry around of Jesus, by and large, is him crucified. It's actually like one of those warnings you see on a joint compound bucket or a dangerous motor. This is what could happen to you if you open your heart. That was a really bad day for Jesus, maybe 6-8 hours. The last 2,000 years, as I understand, he's been at one with his divine beloved Father. And there's no sell-by date on that. We don't focus on the outcome of that, which is the same as what Buddha talked about, which is the same as what any enlightened being has talked about. So we have to recognize it's going to happen small. It's going to happen in Diane's poem. It's going to happen in Michelle's reading. It's going to happen in the sweat lodge right before my vision quest when we sang the final traditional song in a Hikariya dialect. Beauty comes from this place. From this place, beauty comes. It's a koan. What is that place? Ken said thoughtfully, that place is this moment. That place is this moment. Just like Jeff said before we gathered, heaven is a decision. And the beautiful thing about this gathering here is we can come together and make that decision, and everybody does it differently. Charles is musical. He brings us all together to sing. George shares a beautiful forum where no one's right, no one's wrong, after every celebration. People like Dottie and Chris have been here from the beginning. When I was blundering around in law school in the 1980s with no clue about the third turning, they were creating a place that I would come to a generation later and find welcome and comfort. So to me, the good news, it has to start small. Like Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small, committed group of people can change the world, because it's the only thing that ever has. And the fact of the matter is, Homo sapiens evolved to work in groups no bigger than this. Granted, we've achieved huge cities, stadiums, all that. How's that working for you? How good are humans? How well do we operate in numbers like that? You know, it's like if you put too many mice in a cage, they start eating each other. That density is deadly. Our urban densities are deadly. Look at the crime. Look at the greed. We need to go back to small groups and just trust. Buddha talked about it. Jesus talked about it. The white buffalo calf woman. Omatakweyesin. All my relations. Not just my human relations. The four-leggeds and the wingeds and the creepy crawlies. And what is this place about? The third turning's happening right here. We just have to be a little humble. The turnings don't just snap on. It's not like marketing Teslas or Google or sales on Amazon. It starts small. We don't get discouraged when a baby is tiny and helpless. We know what it's going to become. We have to trust that the visionaries and the prophets and the heart wise of the last 2,500 years have been talking about the third turning very regularly. It's just that now it's a matter of survival. So really, all we have to do is become enlightened. And of course, the ego, that never happened. It'll never happen. Of course, that works very well for the ego. But the fact is, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, it doesn't need to be an individual proposition. It happens in groups. This is how Homo sapiens operates, in small groups. And in small groups like this. So I want to thank you so much for carrying the embers of the third turning.